This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, it is the doubling down of a relationship that's already existed for many years. We're talking about that between two very well-known household tech giants that have been in the news a lot, and we're talking about Apple and Google specifically.
Yeah, this story by Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, an exclusive, and it's among the most read stories on the Bloomberg Today. It certainly caught the attention, too, of investors, sending both stocks higher today and giving a lift to the overall equity trade today.
All right, so let's get to it. For more on what's going on, let's bring in Mark Gurman on his story. Mark is Bloomberg News Chief Technology Reporter, joining us from LA. Along also with us is Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor for Global Technology, Tom Giles. He's here in studio. Mark's story, though, as we said, an exclusive among, I think it's a top, the most read. Mark, let's start with you. Lay it out for us in terms of the news and what you are hearing.
Yeah, we are hearing that Apple and Google are in talks for Apple to license Gemini, that's Google's top generative AI large language model, for integration into the iPhone and iOS 18 and the iPad later this year. Apple has its own homegrown AI, including some Gen AI that will be baked into the device. Those will be models that run on the phone themselves. But what a lot of consumers are clamoring for are like Gemini, Microsoft Copilot, ChatGPT, the ability to type in a short prompt and get an essay, a letter, or an image, or whatnot created for you. That's very reliant on the cloud. It's a very expensive endeavor. Obviously, that comes with a lot of challenges and scrutiny as well. And so Apple felt like going with a partner, at least this year, is in its best interest. It has talked to OpenAI, and it has talked to Google. The OpenAI talks happened recently, but the Google talks are active. And it appears both Google and Apple are keen on getting something done by June. Obviously, this could still fall apart, but this is what's happening right now, the two being in discussions.
Hey, Mark, does it also tell us a story? Does it tell you a story about where Apple is when it comes to its progress on AI right now?
Or lack thereof?
Yeah, that's the real question.
It tells us that Apple has not made as much progress as it would need to on the generative AI and cloud-based generative AI front specifically. I do think they have made a lot of progress on-device AI and day-to-day usability, but either it has not made progress or it doesn't feel like it needs to make progress on cloud-based Gen AI, specifically based on short prompts. I would imagine it does come down to the fact that they know they need to get this out this year. They know Google's the best. Why not expand that search deal, maybe make some money off of it too, while having far less liability than they would if they went in-house.
Yeah, I do feel like the pressure is on all of the big tech names to kind of really move forward when it comes to AI. Tom Giles, come on in on this, because I feel like when you hear Apple and Google get together on anything, I feel like exponentially the impact, and I think about regulators just being like, wait, what are you two doing now again?
As we saw this story coming together, the wheels in my head started turning immediately. My thinking is DOJ and FTC are going to look at this agreement, should it come together, with great interest. Hmm. As we all know, DOJ is already looking into that relationship between Apple and Google that gives Apple added prominence on the iPhone.
When it comes to search, right?
When it comes to search, right. But so if you see something that deepens the relationship between two of the most powerful companies in the world, right, you're going to want to make sure that that's not something that's going to thwart competition or in any way hurt the consumer, somehow keep competitors from getting into this space. So there's lots of questions that they have that they're going to ask. And already the FTC is looking at the relationship when it comes to AI between Microsoft and OpenAI. So these kinds of things, they're going to
Where's my whiteboard? I'm assuming you guys have this massive whiteboard.
They're going to want to look at the the details, the fine print.
So Mark, it's funny when you talk about Apple and Alphabet, you know, they're certainly competitors to the extent that Alphabet has the Android operating system, which, you know, is the biggest operating system in competition with Apple's iOS. But at the same time, they are partners, and Apple has had partnerships with once rivals in the past. I think back to this event in 2015 when I think it was an iPhone event or maybe an iPad event where a Microsoft executive was on stage, and it was such a big deal that like a Microsoft executive was actually on stage at this event. If this partnership comes to fruition, is it that big of a deal or is it not that big of a deal because Apple and Google have had a partnership in the past?
I certainly remember that iPad Pro announcement that was in September 2015. And Microsoft at the time, under their new CEO, Satya Nadella at the time, their goal was to get their software and services everywhere. Apple's goal at the time was to make the iPad more of an office device. And so there was some mutual benefit there. Getting Office on the iPad would be good for both parties. In this case, getting Gemini built into the iPhone would also be good for both parties. Apple would be able to push new AI features that everyone's clamoring for to its 2 billion users. And Gemini would be gaining many more users and a stronghold on, you know, one of the most popular devices of our lifetimes, right? And I want one more thing I want to add. Tom's point is excellent about the FTC and the DOJ. Our thinking on this is that in order to combat those concerns, Apple probably will have to have an API or some sort of feature for other generative AI providers, maybe OpenAI, maybe Anthropic, maybe someone else, to be able to integrate themselves into iOS as an alternative. And better yet, Apple probably would have to let users choose when you boot up the phone for the first time who you want your generative AI provider to be. Or as Tom said, the DOJ and FTC are going to be smelling around pretty quickly.
I also do wonder about Gemini, Apple, Google. Who benefits more? You just said, Mark, Gemini into the iPhone, it's good for both parties. Did one of them need to do this more than the other? Was the pressure on Apple to get moving? Yeah.
I would say the easy answer is the pressure is more so on Apple, but I think there's pressure on both companies, okay, right? Google, you know, search obviously is down. Google is looking for, you know, new areas of growth and getting its, you know, next big thing on the world's biggest or second biggest platform. You know,
yeah,
a big deal for them. They're already owning their own in-house platform. They'll own number one, and now they could own number two on AI as well. So I think the pressure is probably equal on both. Maybe more so on Google, because I think if Apple didn't do anything this year on the AI front, if they didn't do this, it would be a bad look. We'd certainly criticize them heavily for it. But would their revenue drop significantly? Would people stop buying iPhones? Probably not. So certainly maybe the pressure is more on Google, but certainly on both.
From the investor point of view, you have to look at the perception that there are some players that are far further ahead when it comes to generative AI. A lot of people are giving a lot of props to Satya Nadella and Microsoft for getting in on that relationship with OpenAI at an early stage, making a big investment and being seen as leaders. There's a lot of criticism about Google, on the other hand, as being something of a laggard. They should have been way ahead of the game when it comes to AI. They've got DeepMind. They had their own AI team at work. Sometimes those two teams worked at loggerheads with each other.
Right.
They're getting that better, but they are seen as being behind Microsoft and its relationship with OpenAI. You see Meta coming from out of left field with its LLMs, it's open sourcing them. There's a lot of momentum behind that, and Zuck is putting a big push behind that. And Apple, of those big players, you really would like to see Apple being in that conversation. It's not in those conversations. It's not being mentioned in the same breath. Microsoft, OpenAI, and even Google.
It does feel like today's news has kind of like changed that, right? Or like all of a sudden the conversation maybe, all right, we're I don't know, that Apple all of a sudden we're looking at differently a little bit, potentially.
That it has a strong relationship with Google, and it's going to capitalize on that and weave more of those AI features into the iPhone, providing a huge platform and a huge validation for what Google's been doing. Both have the potential to benefit tremendously from this.
And Tim, I think about how much we've talked about Google, right? And the criticism of Gemini specifically in terms of some of the biased concerns.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that, Mark, because it was just a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about all the challenges that Alphabet was facing in its AI ambitions. And the CEO of the company had to essentially come out and say, well, you know, wait a second, this is not acceptable to us. And we're working on this to try to make it better.
Yeah, no, for those unfamiliar, there was some controversy on Twitter and other social media about, you know, which races were portrayed in a historical context. This is my understanding. My understanding is that Google would provide the Gemini underlying model to Apple, right, which apparently did not have the issue. And this particular issue that Sundar Pichai, as you said, commented on and was at the center of the controversy was related to the end user interface of the Google chatbot. So it's apparent that, or apparently from what I'm told, this issue wouldn't have been replicated on the iPhone integration.
You know, it's really interesting. Tim and I are both reading Kara Swisher's book that kind of takes you through so much in the technology world. And I know our own team has really just chronicled it so well over the last couple of decades or the last decade and a half. But I just think about how, you know, Tom, there are companies that were so much seemingly at the forefront, then all of a sudden they weren't. And I do feel like you see this jockeying among, especially some of the establishment, of like, we got to be on this because this is what we all think is the next wave.
Well, I'm really struck by, if you look at the share price of these companies, I mean, Apple rocketed ahead, became the world's most valuable company, but its stock has kind of, you know, taken a turn for the worse. By contrast, I'm fascinated by, you look at the share price for Meta, on the other hand, a couple of years ago, Meta was on the ropes. We were talking about the existential threat posed by companies like TikTok, for example. We were talking about the things that Apple has done. In sort of changing and making it harder for you to monetize advertising on the iPhone. And that really hurt Facebook. A couple of years ago, their stock was tanking as a result of all these things. Now look at how Meta's performing vis-a-vis Apple. The story has changed dramatically.
Well, Tom, I'm curious about this idea of a land grab for AI going on right now, because each of these big mega cap companies has their own identity, right? Facebook, Meta owns social networking. Apple owns the iPhone and the mobile operating system, at least at the high end, right? You have Alphabet that owns search. You have Microsoft, which would say that it owns productivity, but it plays in a lot of different areas. And now they're all going after what is essentially the same thing. Is there any sort of historical corollary for this when you have so many companies that are known for their own thing kind of going after a new thing?
Yeah, and some of them do better than others. I mean, the internet, some of them, you know, built themselves on that. And others got left behind. Microsoft comes to mind, for example, when it comes to mobile telephony. You know, Apple sprinted ahead and really has owned that space. Google came in and with Android has done very, very well. Mm-hmm. But if you look at dominance of the hardware and of the US market, Apple has kind of really run away with that. Microsoft went nowhere.
So, Mark, come back in on, because I think about just the last, is it week or so, or 2 weeks or so, Apple giving up on the car after 10 years, and now this, you know, potential deal, it looks like, with Google moving kind of all in pretty aggressively, it feels like, with artificial intelligence. How are you kind of looking at Apple holistically right now on this news?
The presence of new artificial intelligence software and capabilities doesn't change the underlying idea that Apple's a hardware company that makes 75% to 80% of their annual revenue from hardware. So even if they fix this underlying problem with the lack of artificial intelligence, or even when they do, as I should say, doesn't fix the underlying notion that they don't necessarily have a next generation hardware product to make money off of. Now, here's where those two things come together. AI could enable all sorts of new hardware products in the future.
What do you mean by that?
The very core of that would have, well, the car was an AI product. right? A self-driving car is AI hardware. Right. And now that AI hardware is no longer happening. So they're going to have to figure out some sort of new hardware category, whether it's based on AI probably or not, to really move the needle revenue-wise. The iPhone has completely plateaued. The iPad has been sinking. The Mac has plateaued. Some of their other products, AirPods, Apple Watch, et cetera, those are growing, right? But those are not meaningful contributors to the bottom line. The jury is still out on the Vision Pro. There are some other future categories that they're working on. Some right. I'll mention now and some I won't, including AirPods with cameras, augmented reality glasses. But those don't really change the fundamental story. The question is, what is the next big thing that could bring as much revenue and interest in as a car? And I think even for Apple right now, it's a little unclear.
Hey, Mark, I've got a question for you. In the last few seconds, can you talk about where and how Apple might use this for Vision Pro?
And real quick, Mark, about 30 seconds.
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So there is some AI in the Vision Pro, but nothing like you've seen from what Meta has been able to do with their headsets integrating AI. There is a future I see where the Vision Pro cameras could tap into this new generative AI that they're getting from Google and their in-house to unite those two things. You could be walking around a grocery store, the artificial intelligence could pair with those cameras, tell you more about a food item you're looking at. Or you look at a player at an NBA game, the AI combined with those cameras could tell you their stats or what their three-point percentage is depending on where they're standing behind the arc.
All right, now I totally kind of get it. All right, I wish you guys could just stay for the next hour. We so appreciate it. Mark Gurman, Bloomberg News Chief Technology Reporter, and of course, Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor for Global Technology, Tom Giles, joining us in studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Check out the Treasury trade. The yields along the curve, you got that two-year note climbing to its highest level this year, right now at 4.73, but we were above that level. And then you had Fed swaps pricing in less than a 50% odds of a June rate cut. So this is kind of your backdrop for the Wednesday Fed meeting, Tim.
I think needless to say, a bit of an adjustment over the last few months about rate expectations. Yeah. Just 48 hours from now, of course, we are going to have our second Fed decision of 2024. While rates are expected to stay unchanged, we will get an update on the Fed's projections for rates this year, and of course, also on the U.S. economy.
All right. It is without a doubt one of our key focal points this week for investors. With some thoughts on the rate environment and recent moves, let's bring back Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist Ira Jersey. Ira, they're out in our BI headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. Ira, I feel like whiplash, man. Listen, hard to ignore what's going on in rates, I feel like, over the last week once again. Give us an idea. I mean, here we have, what, a 10-year at 4.33, a two-year note at 4.73, and we're off kind of the highs of this session. It does feel like we are pushing up against some of the recent highs here. Does it mean that we could go even higher? How are you looking at the trade as of late?
Yeah, so obviously the market's taken out a lot of the risk that the economy was going to slow down significantly, that the Federal Reserve was going to cut interest rates very aggressively later this year. And now it's taking a more modest approach. So right around 4.7% is what we have on fair value for the Federal Reserve cutting three times this year and then four times next year. So we're basically right there, right? And so I think that we're now to get more direction on where the front end's going to go. It's probably going to come more more from the economic data than it will from Wednesday's Fed meeting. You know, I don't think Jay Powell is going to say much different than you've heard in recent Fed speak. So he's going to say we're data dependent. We're going to move if we have to or when we can. So we'll be concentrating on some of the nerdy, really details of some things as opposed to, you know, when exactly the Fed's going to cut, whether it's June, July, maybe not till November.
We like the nerdy stuff here, Ira, so share it with me, share it with us. What about when it comes to sort of as we get out of the curve a little bit on the 10-year? What's your focus on sort of expectations over the next few months and perhaps this year?
So the 10-year rate at this has been moving along with interest rate policy. So you look at what's been moving, it hasn't really been inflation expectations. Inflation expectations have been pinned basically between 2.2 and 2.4% according to the TIPS market. So most of the moves in treasuries recently has come from real yields. So basically the idea that the Federal Reserve is going to switch policy, interest rates are going to remain volatile or not volatile, in this case more volatile. So because of those things, you've seen TIPS yields, like 10-year TIPS yields, back up again toward 2% and pushing up toward there, toward that area. And if the Federal Reserve does actually ultimately cut, you'd likely see real yields, so those TIPS yields come down a little bit, but we're not quite there yet. So I think further out the curve, it's still about Fed policy expectations and what they're doing. That nerdy stuff, though, that I was talking about were things like the Fed balance sheet policy, because they mentioned, Jay Powell mentioned that at this meeting they would start to talk about what they were going to do with their balance sheet, how balance sheet runoff was going to be maintained for longer but at lower levels. I suspect that after this meeting, we won't get an answer or recommendation, but Jay Powell might lay out two or three options of what the Federal Reserve is considering or discussing, and that's kind of where the rates nerds like myself will wind up focusing a lot of our time.
I do also keep thinking about, with rates staying kind of higher for longer, it feels like, or just at least the Treasury curve kind of moving up here, that how much of the work is ultimately being done by Treasury investors versus what the Fed has to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because, even though the curve's inverted more, there was a lot of talk when we were priced in for 6 interest rate cuts this year that the financial conditions were too easy, that the market was easing in front of the Federal Reserve. And the market's always going to do that in the modern world, right? The market's always going to anticipate what the Fed's going to do. So in this environment, I agree with the idea that, you know, financial conditions aren't as tight as they were, but you look at things like credit spreads, you look at lending conditions in general, and they haven't tightened that much over the last 3 months. So you're still in an environment where the Fed might be forced to maintain rates a little bit higher than some people expect until it's very clear and obvious that the economy is slowing to a very great degree. So you're talking about the unemployment rate, you know, reaching toward 5% and trending much higher. The last employment report wasn't terrible. Unemployment went up a little bit, but a part of that was just people re-entering the workforce as well. So you have still an okay economy and a Federal Reserve that kind of might need to maintain these levels of rates. You know, potentially it's possible throughout the rest of the year. I don't think that's the case. I think we will have a slowing in the economy where they'll cut at some point. But it's possible that maybe they only cut, 50 basis points before the end of this year.
So two cuts then?
Well, that's definitely a possibility. Okay. I think if the Federal Reserve were to cut in July, then they'd probably wind up cutting 3 times. But there's it's not clear what the near-term path of the economy is going to be. You still have spending and retail sales that are reasonably robust. Yes, the retail sales number missed, but when you look at the overall trend, it's still pretty decent. And the employment situation is good. So unless you wind up seeing inflation come down significantly or the unemployment rate pop up a lot the next 2 months, the Fed might not do anything until after the elections. That's not our base case for sure, but that is certainly a realistic possibility.
Well, one thing that we know the Fed will do on Wednesday is release an updated summary of economic projections, the so-called dot plot. What's the smart thing to be looking for in the dot plot, Ira? And what are the questions we should be asking ourselves when we're looking at it?
Yeah, so you know, the 2024 dots will get a lot of attention. You know, people and, you know, all the news media outlets and the like will wind up focusing on, you know, will the Fed start cutting in June or July, or, you know, are there now you know, two cuts in the dots, or three as the median? By the way, we think it'll remain at three, but there'll be some changes in some of the dots. The most important thing to me and to the long term for the Treasury market, like 10-year Treasuries, will be the 2025 and 2026 dots. So what does the Federal Reserve anticipate doing in terms of the terminal rate, right? So it's not so much, you know, when they're going to cut here and there. Yes, that's a nice talking point. But it's, does the Federal Reserve anticipate cutting to 3%, 2.5% as the long run, or is that going to change? Because maybe they think that the economy is going to be more robust than they think, even if it does slow down. So if that long-term dot or the 2026 dots are a little bit higher than they were in December, then I think that 10-year yields, might move higher, might see 4.5% yet again if they were to move those dots up.
Just fascinating to kind of watch it in the moves. But we talked about volatility, and we've certainly seen a fair amount, but it is pretty remarkable what we've seen in the last week. Hey, Ira, thank you so much. Ira Jersey, Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from our BI headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. And just, a quick recap, 10-year at 4.33. You got a 2-year note with a yield of 4.73, stuck in the middle there. A 5-year note with a yield of 4.35 here. But we'll see. You know, we're going to have a big Fed special. Radio, TV, YouTube, and Bloomberg Originals. Our gang will be on it on Wednesday. So it'll be interesting to see what we get in terms of those projections.
It's not a 5% on the 10-year like in October.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, there it is.
Tick, 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 tick. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
This story was reported out by our own Mary Schlangenstein. She reported on a company, it's called JSX, they're a Dallas-based airline, beloved by work travelers for offering convenience like a chartered plane at near business class prices. And instead of flying from packed hubs, it flies from sparse private hangars. In exchange for the amenities of a big airport, passengers get a lot of convenience. So in lieu of long TSA baggage screening lines, they get their bags swabbed for explosives and walk through a weapons detector. So it sounds like kind of move through kind of quickly.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I think what people would argue, I mean, people who've flown it love it. I've talked to them. I haven't flown it before, but people absolutely love it. The thing is JSX is only able to exist thanks to what some airline rivals say is an FAA loophole. The founder and CEO counters that they're just annoyed that he's treading on their turf. We've got that founder with us, Alex Wilcox, founder and CEO of JSX, and Mary Schlangenstein, a Bloomberg News U.S. Airlines reporter. Mary recently, as Carol mentioned, wrote about the airline that's drawn this cult following. Both Mary and Alex join us from Dallas. Alex, we're going to get to you in just a sec, but before we do, I want Mary to kind of lay out her reporting here and explain this loophole, because Mary, you've covered airlines for years. And rivals to JSX say that there's this loophole. Talk to us a little bit about how this airline is able to exist.
Well, basically, they put together two different types of certified air carriers, and they were able to mix, a public charter with what becomes a private charter with two different types of airlines and airline certifications. And basically, it lets them fly an aircraft with more seats, with up to 30 seats, but they don't have to have the normal TSA training or scanning, they don't have to have pilots that are younger than 65. They can have pilots with less flight experience. And so taking advantage of those rules is what's raised some objections to JSX and other carriers like it, but it's also allowed them to operate.
All right, Alex, come on in on this, because regulators, you know, knew what you were doing. They signed off. What do you say to some of these critics who talk about you maybe taking advantage of a loophole?
Well, I mean, I guess one person's loophole is another person's law, and it is just a law. It's 40 to 45-year-old established law. It's law that even American Airlines does, operates under, and they're the biggest complainer of the group here. American Airlines has a co-chair with Contour, which is another Part 135 air carrier that operates exactly under the exact same rules with the exact same pilot experience requirements. They also sell tickets as American Airlines, but you actually wind up flying on Contour or Envoy or SkyWest or Japan Airlines or Gol in Brazil, which only has a 250-hour captain rating requirement. So this is the pot calling the kettle black. They just don't like us. And every argument they make against us is hypocritical when it comes to operations. And a lot of the people that are commenting about safety and security really are not qualified to do so. So we're very proud of our achievements, our near decade of flawless operations. And we see this purely as competitive anxiety.
Alex, having said that, your success, sometimes success brings a lot more eyeballs, including those of regulators. Are regulators coming out to you and saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we need to rethink this?
No, I mean, there's been, because of the efforts of two Dallas-based competitors and their trade unions, they've been begging the regulators to pay attention to us. They went to the DOT, they got turned away. They went to the FAA, 80,000 of our customers came out in strong defense of us. And we turned them away. They went to the U.S. Congress in connection with the current FAA Reauthorization Act, and they tried to get us outlawed under the reauthorization. And politicians from both sides of the aisle, who recognize the value that we bring to their communities, rallied to our support. Again, now they're trying the TSA. They're trying to do it sub rosa with the TSA, with all kinds of baseless threats about security and terrorism and very irresponsible things that, frankly, as an industry, we've always agreed we would never compete on safety and security matters. And so Southwest and American Airlines have crossed that line. Mm-hmm. That is a dangerous line to cross because it actually makes the entire industry less safe because it makes people unwilling to talk about safety and security in an open way, which is the way we make the system better.
Mary, I want to bring you in. You reported this out. You put Alex and JSX on our radar. So come on and ask Alex a question.
Alex, I wanted to ask you if you've heard anything from the FAA, if you've gotten any feedback from them in terms of the timing of their decision, and then also if you've heard anything from the TSA, which was expected to issue some proposed recommendations fairly soon.
Thanks, Mary. Now, the FAA, you know, has not communicated that they're going to be taking any action. They've got to read through those 70,000 comments first and obviously respond to the concerns raised in those things. And then if they're going to make a rule change, they're going to have to go through the regular administrative process to do so. So it'll be an NPRM, a notice of proposed rulemaking, that actually addresses whatever rule they may or may not make. We believe that if there are going to be new rules, they will actually be modeled upon how we operate today. We go well above and beyond many of the rules that do apply to us already. In some cases, we go above and beyond the rules that apply to the major airlines as well. And with respect to the TSA, they will respond to real threats from real bad guys and not from retired airline executives who are taking pot shots.
Hey, Alex, I should note that not all airlines have come out and been critical of your model. Investors in your company include United Airlines, JetBlue, Qatar Airways. So there are some partners that you have with major airlines. But I do want to know, do you have a backup plan at this point, if the FAA were to come out and say, you know, the way that you're doing it is actually not something that we want to approve, what would be your backup plan?
And for those who are actually listening on radio, you're smiling.
Thanks. Yeah, I know. I think there's a couple of things. But first of all, thank you for pointing out it's not the industry as a whole, because I think a lot of the coverage has made it seem as though every major air carrier is against us. And you're absolutely right. JetBlue and United Airlines and Qatar Airways are all investors, proud investors here at JSX. In fact, there's only two airlines that are really outspoken against us, and those are our Dallas neighbors here. American Airlines has a long and notorious anti-competitive history. They've been admonished very recently by a federal judge for what they tried to do in the Northeast as well. And Southwest Airlines, and they also put Legacy Airlines out of business about 20 years ago here in Dallas. And Southwest Airlines is very territorial about Love Field, and understandably so, because they've got a 98% market share. So I think it really is not the industry. It's just American and Southwest, and it's provincial. It's related to Dallas territory. As far as a backup plan, look, I mean, they're not just going to wake up one day and say, hey, you can't do this anymore. They couldn't do that to us anymore than they could do it to the industry. They could say, hey, you've got to do something differently on a safety or a security issue that we've identified and want you to address. And we'll just address whatever that issue is. But the real thing to know about this, and it's also left out of the coverage so far, is that there are only about 480 airports that the entire U.S. industry, major airline industry, can fly to. So if you're going to fly any major airline, there's only 480 airports across the United States. There are over 2,000 other taxpayer-funded airports that right now are available only to people that have access to private aviation. And so if you're going to outlaw public charter, completely, then that means over 2,000 airports in this country will be left with zero access to the average consumer. Anyone that cannot actually buy a ticket, that cannot, rent a private jet or own a private jet on their own, is going to be left to those 480 airports and the notoriously bad service that's offered at most of them by a lot of network carriers. So, the backup plan is that we're just going to comply with whatever we're required to comply with, as we always do. We're going to maintain our outstanding compliance and reputational history, and we're going to continue to focus on our customers. And if we focus on our customers day in, day out, and on their safety and their security and their pleasure, then we're going to be just fine.
Alex, just got about 30 seconds left here. So I don't know, in a year, 2 years, if everything goes as you guys are moving along right now, how much bigger can you become? And just real quickly, only got about 20 seconds.
Sure. As you covered, as Mary well covered, we expect to be at $1 billion run rate within the next couple of years. And, anything is possible once we achieve that. It could be public markets, could be maybe we buy someone here in Dallas.
Could you be bought by somebody too?
Or maybe we'll buy them.
Could you be bought by someone, though?
The company doesn't belong exclusively to me, so that would be a question for our investors.
All right, great stuff as always. Really appreciate it. Alex Wilcox, Chief Executive Officer at JSX, joining us from Dallas. And, of course, our Mary Schlangenstein, U.S. Airlines reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us from our bureau in Dallas. Mary, thank you.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Everybody, TikTok, as I like to say, TikTok, everybody. What do we got, about 18 minutes left in today's trading session?
We haven't talked about TikTok today.
No, how'd that happen?
Yeah, I don't know.
I felt like every day last week. Yeah.
We'll find a way.
The week is young, Tim Stenovic.
Yeah, see what the Senate does, right?
Yeah, exactly. Our next guest has noted, speaking of the markets, though, let's talk more broadly. Our next guest has noted this before, that it's not higher for longer, but longer for longer. And we're about to see this this week as we get ready for Wednesday's Fed meeting. So perfect guest to talk about the Fed and a little bit more.
Yeah, let's welcome back Amanda Agati, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group. She joins us once again from Philadelphia. Amanda, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing really well. Okay, so we'll talk
about the Fed.
I actually
hate Monday, so I'm like, really?
Yeah, come on. By the end of Monday, Carol, you're like, oh,
everybody
that was a good
who
show.
Hates Monday, raise your hand. Like, Amanda, how do you feel about Mondays?
Well, I love Mondays when I get to spend it with you, but that's a big exception to the rule.
Big exception.
All right, Carol, I know you want to ask about NVIDIA.
I do. I want to start there. We'll get into the Fed in a moment, but you had some thoughts on that. I'm looking at the notes that you shared with our producer, Paul Brennan. It's on your radar. It's on our radar. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang expected to make some comments in a keynote today. Your commentary on this one, AI is much more than, I believe, one company is what you said, I think, right? Yes, sorry, I'm looking at my notes here. More than one industry. Let alone one company. So do you think like the obsession that investors have with NVIDIA is a little crazy?
Well, it's a great question to start on. And I would say, yes, in and of the moment, it feels a little bit of a frenzy, right? It does feel a little bit crazy, particularly when you look at some of these forward PE valuations, NVIDIA in particular, trading at a quasi-monopoly valuation level. It's still very early days, right? We haven't seen the fundamentals outside of basically NVIDIA accelerate to justify some of these lofty valuations. But we really do believe in the AI story, and we think that this is really like the next innovation cycle. And so there's so much more to come from this. But I think in the moment, investors are really fixated on one stock, one industry, one company. And we need to think more broadly than that, I think, in terms of this secular theme.
Okay, so what is the best way to get exposure?
Except, can I just wait, jump in for
Please,
a second?
Please, go ahead,
Carol. Because I feel like, you know, we talked about this earlier with, I think, our BI analyst that NVIDIA is kind of in a league all its own, no? Outperforming the semi space, and for a good reason, why fundamentally? So when do you, as someone who watches the market, say, okay, wait, this is a special company, and there's a reason why its valuation might be higher than the rest of the sector that it plays within?
Well, we're already saying that. Now, don't take this as run out and back up the truck and buy a lot of NVIDIA here. But we've already been saying it does stand in a league of its own. And, you know, the expectations from the street continue to be too low relative to the results that they're delivering. And so in an environment where there's a lot of FOMO, a lot of sentiment, a lot of hype around all things AI, NVIDIA really does stand apart from the rest of the pack in terms of being able to justify these valuations. We got a long way to go, right? And I think you saw a little bit of kind of tripping up of the performance in NVIDIA with other companies saying, well, we need to diversify away. We can't be beholden to NVIDIA. But I think NVIDIA is so far ahead of the pack that it's going to take a lot of time to diversify away from them. They have the edge in terms of technology. They have the edge in terms of supply. And so really, where else are you going to go in this environment? I think it's one to watch very closely.
Okay. Well, also to watch is what Jay Powell and co. do starting tomorrow.
Very nice
on Wednesday.
Segue there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So what is the important question that you're going to be asking, or what would you ask Jay Powell on Wednesday if you had an opportunity to chat with him?
I think the question is really not if they should pivot, but when, right? That's really the bottom line here. I think as you teed up very nicely in the beginning, I've been on this mantra of longer for longer. Everything about this monetary policy cycle from tightening to easing is going to take a lot longer than investors in the markets really want. I mean, I think the good news is that the business cycle has been extended. So soft landing camp, right, as opposed to hard landing, which is something we talked about a lot last year. But I think that first rate cut may be a bit more elusive than what investors and certainly the market are thinking. And the good news, bad news is the data is coming in stronger than expected. So we really do think time is on the Fed side as it relates to that first rate cut.
All
That's
right.
important in terms of the market expectations.
Speaking
here.
Of timing and elusive, is it elusive that first rate cut until 2025?
I don't know if I would go quite so far as to say it's 2025, but it's certainly not March and it's certainly not May, given what we're seeing in terms of economic data and then the choppiness around inflation data. I could kind of go either way about whether that first rate cut comes in June. I do think we will get a few cuts this year, right? We do have some cuts baked in, but I don't think the Fed needs to rush. They've been very vocal about not needing to rush. And I think the risk of moving too fast and cutting too soon is much bigger than waiting maybe a month or two.
So, Amanda,
market doesn't believe that, though.
That's true, right? Kind of has its own mind. Well, I'm looking at an S&P 500 that is up, what, about 8% so far this year. And I was just pulling up the NASDAQ 100, and we're looking at a gain of about 7% this year. And we pulled back a little bit from the highs and the what felt like every day we were getting new records on these major equity averages. Having said that, when you say, and the thought maybe that rate cuts are happening later this year, do we get kind of a a bifurcated market, so a market the first half versus the second half, or is a lot of it going to be priced in before we even get those rate cuts?
I don't know that it's a tale of two halves. We've talked about that in the past, mm-hmm. that might be a dynamic in play. I think it's a very choppy sort of range-bound market environment until we start to get some clarity around Fed policy. A lot of it is baked in. You know, we describe the market as being effectively priced to perfection. We pulled forward a lot of the benefits in terms of returns from a policy pivot coming out of the Fed. I think the key is really not so much that first Fed rate cut. It's really what happens to earnings growth. It's been very, very narrow price performance and also very narrow earnings growth performance. We really need to see a broadening to get this market rally engaged again.
How much more of a broadening, because of the equal weight S&P 500 did recently hit an all-time high?
Well, that's not saying much, I don't think.
You want to see more of small caps? You want to see international? What do you want to see?
Yeah, I want everybody on the bandwagon here. And I think it's been very challenging to get
all of the different assets. Wait, are you making a value call? Are you making a value call right now? I mean, the call that everybody's been calling forever?
No, I'm definitely not saying that. I think it's actually a little bit early for value, deep value, cyclicals, and the small cap end of the spectrum. We just haven't seen signs of life from an earnings perspective in those areas yet. But we're going to start maybe getting more interested in those areas as the year progresses. It's just been very narrow leadership, even more narrow this year than last year. And I think that's really, you know, somewhat precarious in terms of keeping this market rally going here. We need broader based participation.
All right. You made the Monday better. I'm just going to let you thank you. So appreciate it. Amanda, be well. Have a great week. Amanda Gatti, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management, joining us from Philadelphia.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.